Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and it is mid-May 2009, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show, a two-hour show every second week through BBS Radio. And I've been on air now for almost 3 years with a wealth of material up on the archive service through BBS. The show explores mystical, esoteric, and occult teachings, as well as modern science, trying to interrelate science and mysticism and looking at the issue particularly of the nature of human consciousness and self-existence. My website is at zeropoint.ca. The CA stands for Canada, and I'm coming to you directly from just south of Ottawa, Canada. My interest, I'm a psychologist and have been for 30 years, and my lifelong interest was in the nature of human consciousness and what we mean by that term. And it's unlikely there's any other term which has as many meanings and interpretations and is as widely used as the word consciousness. In fact, the consciousness literature, in a sense, is like a Tower of Babel. Everybody uses the words differently and has different meanings for the word consciousness. So it's a very confused and difficult area. And human consciousness, the issues of consciousness, are really the number one enigma or unexplained factor in modern psychology and science, because we know that our understanding of the nature of the world also depends on our understanding of the nature of ourselves. We have to understand ourselves as observers in order to understand the nature of the world. And the main thrust of my studies of consciousness has led me to what I call the heart doctrine. And this is a concept that we find in all of the esoteric teachings, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the Tibetan Buddhism of the Dalai Lama, and so on, that a human being's essential self is connected to the heart rather than being produced by the mind in the head, which I call the head doctrine. So the whole of modern science for the past century has assumed that the mind is in the head, and that mind in the head produces consciousness somehow. Whereas in all the mystical teachings and esoteric teachings, a person's true self exists within the lotus of the heart, the flower of the heart, or the rose of the heart. So the self-existence in the mystical literature is described as involving a God spark or divine spark or a monad, and that's connected to the heart and the actual higher dimensional physics to the human heart. So it's very hard to understand consciousness, and I could never explain it to people, because seriously, the only way to understand consciousness is through self-study, and you can never be told what it is and acquire an understanding of it from some external source. Even though esoteric teachings are very valuable to learn, because they guide us in trying to understand what is consciousness. So one point I'm making then is that I argue that human consciousness originates out of the heart, and in the body it's connected to the circulation of blood. And we find this idea also throughout the mystical literature, that blood flow, that consciousness within the body is connected to blood flow. Thus, if I put my attention into my right hand, put my consciousness there, or simply try to be fully conscious of my right hand, that increases the blood flow to my right hand, and my right hand will actually engorge a quarter of an inch, become larger. And that's simply by directing my attention. And there are many see, in Western science, everybody thinks that all your consciousness of being is all up in your head. They think your emotions involve your limbic system. This is like in the movie, What the Bleep Do We Know, where they connect emotion. The emotional center is regarded as in the limbic system, or what's called the old mammalian brain, according to McLean's triune model of the brain. And certainly the experimentation shows that when animals are stimulated in the limbic area, it arouses all kinds of emotional reactions, rage reactions, mainly negative emotions they elicit by stimulating the limbic system. So scientists have taken this as the source of emotional experience. I would argue this is completely fraudulent, and I would argue that really the basis for emotional life is the human heart and the autonomic nervous system, and that we experience body emotions through our body in association with the blood flow and the autonomic nervous system. One never goes home and tells your other half that you love them with all your head. It would sound ridiculous. People intuitively connect love and compassion with the human heart. And through the religious traditions, we find that compassion and love are primary roots by which religions describe how one comes to know God, is through awakening of the heart and achieving love of God or love of one's fellow human beings. So in spiritual psychology, the heart, I would say, is the primary focus and most important initial focus of the awakening of a human individual. And once awakened in the heart, then there's an increase in interior light. See, I would equate consciousness in a way with light. It's light that illuminates the inner world, allowing awareness in the inner world. So we can be conscious of our thoughts and our feelings and our sensations. And we can be conscious of all of these objects of consciousness. But I would say consciousness is not thinking. Consciousness is not emotions. Consciousness is not perceptions. And consciousness is not simply all the thoughts, feelings, and sensations linked together. Instead, the consciousness is something separate. And it's most useful to understand it in terms of light. Just as there's light in my room, which allows me to be aware of all different objects in my room, similarly, there's an inner light of consciousness that allows me to be aware of what's on my mind or what I'm feeling in my stomach or other sensations and emotions. So consciousness is like light. Consciousness is also like space. And this is very interesting to think of the enigmas of space. Like if one considers that at the moment you're existing in space, and consider what is the color of space, and you realize that, well, space itself is colorless. All the objects in space have color, but the space itself is transparent or see-through. You can't see space. You can see objects within space, but the space is invisible. And you can't touch space, you can't smell it, you can't taste it. So space, in a way, is a form of nothingness. It's no thing. But it's a form of nothingness that allows you to be aware of things. All the things, because all the things that you're conscious of exist within the space. So the space itself is like an invisible background of nothingness, which allows us to be aware of all the things, all the contents of experience and of perception and so on. So similarly, consciousness is like space. It is this form of nothingness that allows us to be aware of all the things. In the mainstream of Western philosophy, within the mainstream, the work of Jean-Paul Sartre come most similar to what I'm describing in his great, like, widely known book called Being and Nothingness. And Sartre regarded consciousness as having a special kind of existence from everything else in the world. Because he said everything else in the world, in a sense, it is what it is. It has a form of, he calls it being in itself. It just is what it is. But in a way, Sartre said, consciousness always intends something which it is not. It intends. So I'm conscious of my thinking, I'm conscious of feelings, sensations, so on. But my consciousness is not the thinking, it is not the emotions, it is not the sensations. So the consciousness always exists in relationship to something which it is not. But Sartre argued that the consciousness, in a sense, is this form of nothingness at the heart of being. And he didn't mean it in the mystical sense that I mean it, because I take that to be quite literally true, that consciousness, see, I regard consciousness as a conjunction of light within space. It's like you have a point source of light, and that exists within space. And the illumination of the jiva atma, or the individual self, illuminates within the space. And Aleister Crowley, in the Book of the Law, he described the mysteries of consciousness in terms of what he called the conjunction of hodet and nui. And hodet, for Crowley, hodet was your point source nucleus, your individual self, the star element within the human being. And the first principle of magic, according to Aleister Crowley, is every man and woman and child is a star. So this says the principle of magic, every human being has within them some little star element, which in yoga would be called the jiva atma, the individual self, where Blavatsky would call it the monad, and Shirley MacLaine calls it the God spark. Well, Blavatsky, in the Book of the Law, calls it hodit, H-A-D-I-T. And he describes hodit existing within nui. And whereas hodit represents the male principle, the active principle, nui represents a feminine or receptive principle, and nui represents space. Nui actually is a French word meaning night. So you can imagine looking into a night sky and you see all the little stars all existing within space. Well, imagine, extend that conception to human beings, and you see all these little human beings around you, and all of them have a star connected to the higher dimensional physics of their heart. So Aleister Crowley regards the view of self, he says it's a conjunction of hodet and nui. And this is what I'm saying, is that consciousness first as light is related to the hodet side, because hodet is the star, and that star has light or illumination. So there's illumination in the inner world. And that illumination exists within space, which is nui. So for Crowley, it's a conjunction of hodet and nui. And that is how, and that those represent the two basic ideas that I came to in my study of consciousness, is trying to understand consciousness as light and consciousness as involving no-thingness, or similar to the nature of space. So consciousness is like light within space. And my views differ widely from those even in the modern alternative literature. even in the New Age literature, many writers still regard the mind as basically the mind in the head, connected to the brain. And I know few other or no other psychologists or mystics who argue so, well, I know mystics who argue for the heart doctrine, but I don't see other scientists, even in their studies of mysticism, considering seriously this idea that the human being's consciousness originates out of the heart, and that there's actually a higher dimensional physics to the heart. Okay, and on today's show, we're going to go into some of this physics of the heart, but we're going to go into it from a circuitous route a little bit, because we're going to discuss a recent review done of my book based on H.P. Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine. And The Secret Doctrine, Volume 1 of The Secret Doctrine, deals with cosmogenesis, meaning the cosmos. Genesis means the creation or origin of something. So cosmogenesis deals with the creation of the universe or of the cosmos. But in a mystical perspective, there's the axiom that as above, so below, or as in the macrocosm, so in the microcosm. So I would say a lot of the physics of the origin of the universe apply similarly to understanding the mysteries of Hadet within Nui, or the self within the higher dimensional physics of the heart, and that the physics that can be applied in creation studies also applies to human beings. And I hope you get a sense of that today through this show. Okay, so I'd like to introduce a co-host, James Moffat from outside of Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim, how are you?
In the heart of Toronto, what are you talking about?
The heart of Toronto.
Right downtown.
Yeah.
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Good.
Yeah, so I mean, just to comment on just something you said, it's like it's the physics, but it's also the metaphysics, right? Like that you're describing of the higher dimensions of the heart, because in a way, It is physics, but it's also metaphysics, because it's wrapped. What you're describing is, in terms of schemes that are outside sort of the parameters of modern physics. I mean, they relate to and they involve the parameters of modern physics, but they're also metaphysical principles, I would say.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's in The Secret Doctrine. It's like Blavatsky says, all physics carried far enough lead to metaphysics.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Yeah, so in a way I say, yeah, it has to do with the physics of the heart, but really it's a model of the higher dimensional physics of the heart.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, which we'll come to today when we go into The Secret Doctrine a bit. But, yeah, it's useful to use both of those terms. I like to use physics sometimes because I'm saying this is a very practical, real thing, like,
yeah.
Look at the actual physics of the body.
Yeah.
Like, it was interesting, I viewed an interesting little video from the Heart Math Institute this last week.
Okay.
And it was a 1 minute video they have called The Shift. Kind of and anyway, it was all about the electromagnetics of the heart. And they had these beautiful illustrations which just showed this whole field existing with a toroidal structure around a human being, all centered in the heart. And the electromagnetic volume of the heart is said to be 5,000 times greater than the electromagnetic volume of the mind in the head. So when you think of that, in that way, considering all of life is electromagnetic, then the true center of a human being would have to do with this electromagnetism of the heart and the field generated within the heart. So I like to use the word physics sometimes because I'm meaning it in a very practical, physical way. I mean, they can measure the electromagnetic field of the heart like 30 to 40 feet away.
Yeah.
Because it extends as a field around people. And I think people, often we feel other people's fields around us. And, you know, this, I think, is tied into ESP and psychical sensitivity and sensitivity to other people's feelings and so on is the fact that we have these heart feels. And those are the predominant feels in a human being rather than the mind in the head.
What was the institute?
Heart Math.
What is that? What?
Oh, have you never heard of that? Oh,
no, I don't know what that is.
Oh yeah. Oh, I'm shocked a bit. Well, it's a very famous institute in California. It's called the Heart Math Institute, and they regard the heart as the primary center of human vitality and emotional life, and their whole emphasis is on helping people and empowering people through establishing coherent patterns within the heart rhythms.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, look up the Heart Math Institute. They do very valuable work. In fact, I would say they're more similar to my work than any other institute or individual coming from a scientific perspective issues. Even though they don't go into the kind of metaphysical aspect of it so much as I do. And they don't have the zero-point concept, but, yeah, the Heart Math Institute. Paul Pearsall was associated with them.
Oh, that was going to be my next question. So Paul Pearsall was associated with this group.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he worked for them, but
okay.
But
okay.
They certainly endorsed Pearsall's work. And
oh yeah, of course.
But I heard a couple of weeks ago a repeat of Art Bell with Paul Pearsall on Coast to Coast. If you ever have a chance to hear that interview, it is one of the most amazing interviews.
Yeah, really.
I think we discussed that a week or so ago.
Yeah, I mean, people who don't know Pearsall's work, The Heart Code is I don't know how long ago that was published, about 10 years ago maybe?
Yeah, at least.
Very interesting, very revolutionary approach to the study of the heart and consciousness, and very valuable, valuable book, smart book.
Yeah, and beautifully illustrated with clinical experience on. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's odd how scientists in the mainstream haven't taken up the challenge essentially posed by Pearsall's work, like it is by my own, but Pearsall's more within their domain still.
Well, I would say that that's sort of akin to the whole lack of response to the positing of the holographic paradigm. So almost 30 years ago, it's really never gotten off the ground in terms of scientific research, and even though I think a lot of very interesting and influential people certainly were, I mean, well, David Bohm, for instance, a theoretical physicist of great importance, but it's odd how, to me, it's very odd that paradigm has never really been developed and explored, or even, like, I mean, you can read entire books on the nature of memory and never once ever see any reference to the holographic paradigm and Carl Priebram, who is a prominent, one of the most eminent neurologists of the 20th century and subscriber to the holographic, one of the major figures in the development of the holographic paradigm, and yet you'll never see one reference even to Priebram's holographic model of memory. It's really peculiar how that they're just sort of it's been marginalized, and I would say the same thing about Pearsall's work. Like, it's odd how it doesn't seem to have had much impact, really.
Yeah, it is odd.
Yeah, it's really odd, actually.
Yeah.
I agree.
Like, just sticking with what you're saying about the holographic paradigm, I think what's most interesting, how it didn't flourish more, it has to do with this idea or a fact that in the holographic paradigm, it all has to do with how you have a laser that produces a source of coherent light, and that light is reflected. Part of it is it's divided by a partially coated mirror, so that half of the beam of light bounces off an object, say an apple, and that's called the object beam that illuminates the apple. And then you have the other part of the consciousness, which is called the referent beam, and it doesn't interact with objects at all. And then what you have is a holographic plate where the two interfering wave patterns, the reference beam and the object beam interact on the plate, and that the interaction of those wave beams produces a wave interference pattern on the holographic plate. And when you shine a light through the holographic plate, it projects an image of the whole apple. Any part of the plate has an image of the whole of the apple. Now, in the whole holographic paradigm, it all is dependent on having a coherent source of light energy. But none of the scientists, in applying the model to human beings, ever considered that there might actually be a source of coherent light energy within a human being. And I remember Carl Prebram being interviewed by Omni magazine, and the reporter asked him, "You mean, is there a laser beam in the head?" And Carl Prebram says, "No, there's no laser beam in the mind. We only developed the paradigm because of how the same mathematics, Fourier transforms, could be applied to psychological data as other data. So psychological processing seemed to occur on holographic principles." But they never had the idea that, yeah, a human being has a point source of coherent light within the higher dimensional physics of the heart, which is what I would say. So I'm saying, with this idea of hadit within nui, or the divine spark within the higher dimensional space of the heart, that's the basis on which you can really have a holographic psychology. And I think partly the holographic paradigm didn't develop more because people didn't seem to conceive of that idea or consider that, I guess mainly because of the materialist outlook of modern science. No one would consider that there might be a source of light within the human being.
Yeah, I think you're giving them too much credit, but I think everything you're saying is exactly right. I think that's where your work really develops the holographic paradigm in a very, very interesting way, in a coherent way, though, which is that there is there isn't a laser beam in your head. He's right, but there is a coherent light source, which is rooted in, it comes from the heart, and that's essentially what the entire mystical and esoteric tradition suggests, is that whereas Western science and modern science and psychology suggests that the mind arises out of the neuronal activities of the brain and the head, in the mystical tradition, it suggested that there is a light source which arises in the heart, and that it's like the mind and the head is compared to the moon, and the light from the heart is compared to the sun. The moon reflects the light of the sun, and the mind and the head reflects the light which arises from the heart. And that's a fundamental difference that is gone unrecognized in modern science and psychology. Everybody assumes that all of this activity of the mind arises from the material processes in the brain, and nobody considers how that relates to the heart and to the blood, which is fundamentally not only a sound idea, but an entirely reasonable idea. And the fact that it's repeated throughout these esoteric and mystical teachings, it's quite extraordinary how that is unrecognized too. Even as you say, amongst people who are sympathetic to, or who are interested in mystical and esoteric ideas, it's odd how it's, people don't talk about the heart doctrine, what Blavatsky calls the heart doctrine, what you label the heart doctrine. Very, very interesting how that doesn't get expressed.
Even in the book, I was thinking, as good as Michael Talbot's book, The
Right.
Holographic Universe, which was an excellent book. It was in the mid-80s, almost 20 years ago, when he published that.
Very good book, but it's not there. Yeah, and I mean a guy like Ken Wilber, who has written a lot of books about consciousness, obviously very, well-schooled in Eastern philosophy and mystical and esoteric doctrines. But I read in his writings, I see the head doctrine being expressed repeatedly. It's really odd how he doesn't seem to see it, I was going to say earlier, from the preamble that you began the program with, that, yeah, it's interesting that when you use the word physics in relation, saying there's a higher dimensional physics, it's interesting that there have been a few attempts to kind of reconcile quantum theory with consciousness, but it's always in terms of consciousness arising in areas of the brain, you know, and people
yeah.
want to try to translate these ideas as to how they fit activities in the brain. And, you know, some interesting work has been done, but it's always in terms of the head brain and never in terms of the heart. Very, again, it's this consistent application of this epistemological assumption, which characterizes basically all modern theory and all modern research on consciousness, that it has to do with the brain.
Yeah.
Brain-centric.
And then we see those researchers at the head of the forefront of the consciousness literature who do question it, even though they don't seriously elaborate, like Member
yeah.
Peltier.
Yeah.
He noted how if you were talking to native elders, the natives would say white men were crazy because they thought you thought with your mind, whereas really you thought with your heart.
Yeah.
So they would think that white men kind of didn't know themselves or were deluded. That was in Peltier. And I remember him saying if you wanted to scientifically test an Aboriginal view of consciousness, you'd probably, you'd monitor the heart and the blood flow in the body. So Peltier touched on it in his book, Towards the Science of Consciousness.
Yeah, that's like
and then you see in Stanislav Grof,
yeah.
where his comment is that the assumption that consciousness is produced by the brain is like the fundamental assumption of modern science and psychology, but it's never been proven, and it's only an assumption. And which
yeah.
he then says is obviously not true, because
yeah.
consciousness can exist apart from and independently of the body. And he would maintain that's conclusively established through his work,
yeah.
which is through the study of people's experiences on LSD and psychotropics. At least his early work was. Later work based on his holotropic breath work.
Right.
But still, he didn't see consciousness. See, that's what other people do. Some people say, oh, consciousness isn't connected to the head, but then they say it's like it has no connection to the body and it's everywhere. Kind of like that's the alternative. Like if it's either in produced by the brain or no, it has nothing, it's like it has nothing to do with the physical body.
Yeah, that's like kind of like a panpsychic, philosophical viewpoint that everything is conscious,
yeah.
conscious in some degree, in some way. It's very interesting. Grof says that it's a fundamental epistemological assumption underlying the modern materialist position in science and psychology, but that it's there's no basis for it, really. and as you say, he goes on to argue that his research really provides compelling evidence that it's not true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your book is called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, Zero-Point Metaphysics in the Holographic Space of H.P. Blavatsky.
Jim?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah, you brought that up. Yeah, that's the title of my book.
Yeah. So do you want me to just begin talking?
Yeah, we were going to, do you want to just take the floor a bit? For listeners, this is a review done of my book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, by Donna Brown. And it's available online at www.esotericstudies/quarterly. And it's an outstanding book of review of my book. And I felt really, it's eloquently written and summarizes so much and I think really gives a flavor of the book. And so Jim and I thought today Jim's going to read through the review and we'll kind of stop and have some discussions of the points being made as we go through. Okay, so...
Yeah, I was just going to say that the Esoteric Quarterly is an online journal, and I've just read a little bit of it other than Donna Brown's wonderful review of Chris's book, but I've been really impressed by the quality of the material that they published, and I think people listening to this program would definitely be interested in the Esoteric Quarterly, so check it out. It's free, which
yeah.
is really nice.
And I do have a link to the site up on my website if people can't find the link. If you go to my website, you'll see that there's a link to Esoteric Quarterly.
And you have posted this review.
Yeah, I posted it on my site as well.
Yeah. Okay, so it begins, Donna Brown begins, in 1888, Helena Blavatsky published her masterwork, The Secret Doctrine, on the genesis of the cosmos and the creation and evolution of humankind. It provided a radical paradigm for cosmic, planetary, and human evolution that not only dwarfed past and popular scientific theory, but anticipated many of its most current and striking developments. One of its aims was to contest and counter the mechanistic, materialistic worldview of the 17th and 18th centuries. Blavatsky intended to show that nature was not, quote, a fortuitous concurrence of atoms, unquote, or the result of accidental or random processes, but evolved as a result of an intelligent and profoundly meaningful design. She encouraged the dialogue between esotericists and scientists and advocated for, quote, the secret teachings to be contrasted with the speculations of modern science, unquote.
That's neat about Blavatsky's work, in a way, like she was so wanting to people, like, do that. Like, she would say, don't believe what I'm saying. You know, we need to look at these ideas scientifically. It wasn't just a philosophy. But she was like challenging people to look at her claims scientifically.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important. I think people who know just a little bit about her would be surprised by that. Is that she's not saying like you should believe this because I'm saying it. She's saying that people need to open their minds and look at these ideas and weigh them and try to understand them in the light of modern science and in light of human experience and human history. It's really scientific in the best sense of the word, like having an open mind and trying to examine things empirically.
That's amazing in that regard, her book.
So just to complete that thought, at the end of this paragraph, she says, Donna says that Blavatsky understood that it was only by, quote, placing occult teachings side by side, unquote, with scientific theory, that the origins and ultimate face of the cosmos could be revealed. So there it is. I mean, she's saying that, you know, let's put these things side by side and compare and contrast them and try to come to an understanding of the arising of the cosmos and the fate of the cosmos. So I'll just continue. Over 100 years have passed since Blavatsky issued this call. Quote, while a few scientists and authors are beginning to explore the connection between these wisdom teachings and modern developments in science, unquote, they have, as mystic scientist Dr. Christopher Holmes points out, quote, only begun to scratch the surface, unquote. That was your quote, I assume, that, they, that we began while a few scientists. Okay, Blavatsky's great treasure is still relatively unknown even today. Its abstruseness and the fact that most scientists disapprove of mixing so-called hard science and mathematics with occult and mystical thought have relegated its astonishing mysteries to the realm of religious speculation and the pseudo-scientific.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. Like, we see when we read people like Stephen Hawking and Carl Sagan and a lot of popularizers of science, how when they discuss religion, they present it in such a superficial aspect. Like Sagan particularly.
Well, Richard Dawkins is even worse, you know. But even Stephen Hawking, I'd say I've never read anybody who intelligently who's posing, contrasting modern science and religion, and suggesting that modern science is rational and lucid, and religion is based on faith and lack of evidence. I've never read anybody who puts forth that view who shows any familiarity with the significance of mystical or esoteric thought, or who has any familiarity with what they with what those teachings actually entail, and what they actually say about the nature of the universe and the self and consciousness and all the fundamental most important issues. That just, as you say, it's so superficial, and it's ironic because the great criticism of that skeptics and rationalists put forth to discount religion is that it's based on superficial understanding of things and an unwillingness to examine things in detail and to put them to empirical tests. And yet, in discounting mysticism and esoteric ideas, they commit exactly the same sin. Like, basically, they treat things entirely superficially. They don't examine them. They don't really understand what they're talking about, and yet they're quite sure that there's no meaning there. It's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It reminds me also of that term you used earlier, quote from Blavatsky, where she talks about how the universe was not a fortuitous concurrence of atoms. And what she meant by that is like saying it's not a product of accidental or random factors. Instead, there's design built in from the beginning, and there are intelligences, higher intelligences, Blavatsky claims, the builders. She calls them the builders of form from no form. So Blavatsky is saying there's nothing in nature which is ultimately fortuitous and accidental. Everything is part of intelligent design and patterns of creation. And it's interesting then to look at, when you read so much of modern scientists, how much they subscribe to what we call accident theory, which is whenever they can't explain anything, they say, oh, it was just due to a random genetic changes. Like, that's how they believe evolution occurred, is due to random evolutionary changes, which just happened to have survival value, henceforth those organisms propagated more speciously.
Yeah.
And when you think of it, the more you look at the way the scientists use the word accidental and random, you realize in a way that's a completely pseudo-scientific viewpoint. And they never offer any proof that it is accidental or random. Like, even that proposition doesn't satisfy Karl Popper's criterion for what is a scientific statement, which means that it has to be testable.
Yeah.
And how can you test?
Or disprovable.
Or disprovable. Yeah, thank you. Disprovable. Yeah, there's no way to disprove it. And then even if you do prove, well, it's not just accidental, it was really these factors, well, then they just push that border back a little bit and we'll arrive at another accidental level of the universe. Like they say about the fine-tuning of the universe.
Yeah.
How there are all these factors in physics, like the fine surface constant and the strength of G, the gravitational constant, and the speed of light, all these different factors, the weight of an electron, the charge on an electron, and so on, which if they were slightly different, even like one in a billion parts, well, then life as we know it couldn't have evolved. So there's that great enigma of how did all these features of the cosmos just happen to be right to allow human life to exist. And then the scientists resort to the idea, well, there's an infinite number of universes that are created, and some of them just happen by chance to have the right conditions. So, but it's like it's circular logic, and it's non-testifiable.
Well, that particular position, I think, is that there, you know, the theory that there are these infinite number of universes, and we just happen to live in the one where these, cosmological constants and factors have all worked out to produce life on this planet, and you know, keep the universe in the state that it's in. That always reminds me of the Ptolemaic theory of concentric spheres, which were preserve his conceptualization in light of the gathering of evidence. They had to keep adding all these different corrections to preserve that this basic construction. But it got so absurd that eventually Kepler's work overthrew it. Like this had been the standard position for I don't know, hundreds, even thousands of years, but that's sort of what that infinite number of universes seems to me. It seems completely ad hoc to say, oh, you know, we can't really square this with our observations. We can't square this random explanation with the observation that everything looks non-random. So we'll add an infinite degree of randomness to it to account for the order. Completely absurd. I mean, ridiculous thinking in my estimation. Rather, why not just take what's staring you in the face, what Blavatsky says, that the universe is not the result of a fortuitous concurrence of atoms. I mean, that it's completely backward thinking, and it's not rational, and it's not reasonable in my estimation.
Yeah. And Blavatsky even goes further, because she not only says the universe is created by design, but she also provides some portion of a model of what that design is, which we'll come to today in discussion of the secret doctrine. So she's not only saying it's by design, but then giving a model that is then testable and can be applied to, interpret data in. So Blavatsky isn't just saying this on the basis of belief, but that she then tries to substantiate it. And I don't think scientists who look at religions and so on, none of them seem to grasp that there are any truly scientific ideas in religious or mystical teachings. They don't seem to grasp that. They seem to think it only as superstition and belief and faith, and they don't grasp the esoteric side of the religious teachings.
What's the quote that you have where Stephen Hawking is talking about that it used, in previous centuries nobody believed that?
Yeah, I can quote that here.
Yeah, because I think that's a very good example. It shows sort of his fundamental ignorance of.
He said
esoteric and mystical teachings. That he said that.
Well, in 1984, he said nearly everyone in the 18th and 19th century believed that the universe was essentially unchanging in time. One could equally well believe that it had existed forever, or that it had been created in its present form a finite time ago. Well, Blavatsky was back in the 19th century, and she certainly didn't believe that the universe had always existed. Instead, she was explaining that the universe originated from a point source out of nothingness, and that it expands within, without, that it'll eventually withdraw without, within, back to a zero point, back into hyperspace. So that's what Blavatsky was arguing over a century ago.
And that it involved broken symmetries there are many concepts that are completely consistent with modern physics in terms of cosmological ideas about the nature and origin of the universe. I just thought of one thing I just wanted to add to this, which was we discussed several months ago Bernard Haitch's book, a physicist has written a book called The God Theory, and in that book he says the evidence for a random universe is precisely zero or something.
Yeah, that's what he says. Yeah.
I love that. It was hey, what exactly is the evidence that all of this happened randomly? And yet you'll find people like Steven Weinberg, who recently wrote an article in New York Review of Books, which is very, very, very similar to the views that Carl Sagan. Was presenting 30 years ago in Broca's Brain and in some of his other works about science and religion and the debate between them. He essentially recapitulates a lot of Sagan's positions. He has a quote something to the effect that the more we study the universe, the more random and absurd it seems, or
more pointless.
Pointless, thank you, that's the word, pointless at all is. And yet, that's just, that's a, That's a metaphysical statement. That's not a statement based on physics. That's his opinion and his interpretation, which is not really, there's nothing in physics which would suggest that. I mean, he can say, I mean, it may suggest it, but it certainly doesn't prove it, and it doesn't substantiate it. It's like when Fritjof Capra was, I mentioned this on a previous program, when he was interviewing near the end of his life, he got to speak with Werner Heisenberg, and he noticed that Heisenberg was reading a copy of Chance and Necessity by Jacques Monod, who was a French biologist who won the Nobel Prize. And Monod is one of the most, hardline adherents of the randomness and accidental theory of the universe and of life, and he just completely keeps emphasizing how it's all meaningless and how it's all completely by chance, and you know that there's no covenant with the Creator, and that everything has just happened by accident and everything. And Heisenberg's comment on it was, very good book in terms of the biology, terrible book in terms of the metaphysical pronouncements, because he called it bad metaphysics. Monod's discussions about the meaning of things, he said it was ridiculous. And I was very pleased with, you know, Heisenberg. I mean, it's odd because almost all of the major physicists of the 20th century came to the view that physics can lead us to an explanation up to a certain point, but beyond that, there's still a gap in meaning, and it was Eddington that said that really that mysticism could that's where mysticism, there was still room for mysticism. He wasn't saying that physics was proving mysticism, but he was saying that physics can only reveal sort of the shadow world of things, and that beyond the shadow there's got to be something more in terms of intelligence and meaning. And so he was very sympathetic to a mystical explanation. He wasn't saying that you know, physics has established that mysticism is true, but he was saying that physics certainly did not disprove mysticism and actually made mm-hmm. room for it. And this is really almost like Ken Wilber has a book about the mystical views of most of the major figures of 20th century physics, and they all came to this viewpoint. So, I mean, when scientists are saying, oh, well, science has proved that we're just the outcome of the universe, and human beings are the outcome of all these random processes, well, most of the major 20th century physicists don't even agree with that viewpoint.
Yeah, really.
So, I mean, I think it's odd that none of them really explored Blavatsky, although you've mentioned to me that Einstein apparently kept a copy of The Secret Doctrine on his night tables, but it's odd that nobody's really explored what she says and you know, related it to modern physics.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read that about Einstein, and yet I question it when I look at his work, because in a way, it's the Secret Doctrine was totally inconsistent with aspects of what Einstein's own theories. Like, Einstein always felt that the universe was unchanging, and he didn't believe it resolved back to a zero-point singularity at the beginning of time. So he postulated his cosmological constant so that the universe would be unchanging in time. Whereas if he had read the Secret Doctrine, the whole of the Secret Doctrine explains how universes expand and contract.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. It's like the out-breath and the in-breath. The universes come into existence and eventually they dissipate and return to non-existence.
Was the cosmological constant the what he described as the biggest blunder of his career?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, because he didn't. It was someone else who applied Einstein's thinking of the general theory of relativity and arrived at the formulation that the universe emerged from a singularity condition, which was Blavatsky's view.
Wow.
But so that's why I even put that in my book about Einstein. You know, his niece apparently reported he always had a copy of The Secret Doctrine with him, but I don't see evidence of it in his writing.
Yeah.
And that's curious to me. I'm very interested in that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's funny because, I mean, he also, I mean, he may have been conversant with it and you know, read it, but doesn't mean that, you know, because he certainly was conversant with quantum theory, but he didn't believe it, you know. So, I mean, it may have been he just didn't believe it, you know, because, well, I won't speculate on that. I don't know enough about it, but, you know, that may have been it, too. But as you say, if he had incorporated Blavatsky's ideas, he would have come to a much different understanding about the nature of the genesis and the fate of the universe. So.
Yeah, he wouldn't have postulated his cosmological constant, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Because even the secret doctrine, the stanzas begin when everything is absorbed in nothingness. So that's what the stanzas of Zan deal with.
Yeah.
And, you know, Einstein didn't come up with the idea of vacuum genesis, like the universe appearing out of the quantum vacuum. It took 20 years for that much longer than that. 40 years for that to develop as the standard viewpoint.
But that was articulated in The Secret Doctrine in 1888.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so such a remarkable book. It's just a shame it is so excluded from modern philosophy and scientific circles. Yeah, I just wanted to mention one other. We're talking about this issue of randomness and pattern. It reminds me of that very well-known cartoon where you see two professor types standing in front of a big blackboard. And they have, one of them has this huge, complex mathematical formula on the blackboard.
Yeah.
And then at the very end of the formula, it says, and then a miracle happens.
Yeah.
and that's kind of like what scientists have. They're kind of like, they're all scientific until they get to a certain point, and then, and then the randomness or the accidentalness or the miracle occurred, you know? And that's what they're like. It's like the scientists, it's like the science of Monad versus his metaphysics. And his biological science was valid, but then he's like not a good metaphysical teacher. And you see that in the science writers, that they make that leap of faith. And that's their leap of faith when they ascribe things to random and fortuitous concurrence of atoms. That's their leap of faith, just like a theist makes a leap of faith to the belief in God.
Yeah.
That at a certain point, it's a leap of faith.
Yeah.
So the scientists have a similar leap of faith. Okay, so what do you, I don't know if you had anything. Do you want to pick up where we were going through the book review? We got off talking about,
I was just actually looking at your website. have you updated your website?
Not within the last couple of weeks, but
okay.
In April I did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm going to...
Put a few
new things up there soon.
So after she's talking about that Blavatsky's great treasure is still relatively known even today. Holmes, however, has no such objections and has given himself over to Blavatsky's challenge entirely. That is of laying side by side the ancient teachings and modern science. He seems uniquely placed to relate ancient mystical knowledge to the newest ideas in physics and science. His background includes a doctorate in clinical and forensic psychology and an in-depth understanding of current scientific theory. Over 30 years of study and research have provided him with a wealth of knowledge and insight into the teachings of Helena Blavatsky, the Kabbalah, Judaism, Gurdjieff, and a wide range of esoteric doctrine. Holmes begins by relating how the strange and seemingly incomprehensible stanzas of Zion, which serve as the basis for the secret doctrine, anticipated the newest concepts of cosmological physics and can be understood as representing, quote, a profoundly alternative interpretation of the facts and theories of science itself, unquote. He offers a penetrating look at the cosmogenesis and metaphysics of the secret doctrine that is sure to interest all those who have tried to decipher its hidden mysteries. Well,
yes, that's so good.
It's lovely.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, the point being made about how, like, my interpretation of the secret doctrine allows for, she quotes me, a profoundly alternative interpretation of the facts and theories of science itself. Like, that's, when you read my book, and you read, like, how my discussions of, like, 11-dimensional superstring theory And what you see is, like, I use the facts and theories from science, but just give them a twist to view them in light of Blavatsky's teaching. So, yeah, that's what's so important, I think, about my work is, you know, I use the facts of science, but interpret them in light of the esoteric tradition, which gives them new meaning. It magnifies their meaning.
Yeah, and I think that's the fundamental difference. I mean, I think in the debate between science and religion, I mean, what we're consistently arguing, we're not arguing that science or religion is right. What we're arguing is that if you understand the nature of what's being said in esoteric and mystical teachings, and which underlies most of the major religions, and you try to understand them in light of current science, what it really does, the integration of the two sets of ideas leads to a much more comprehensive understanding of the nature of things. But also, in many ways, esoteric and mystical doctrines really shed light on a lot of the enigmas and anomalies and mysteries that still confront modern science and psychology. That's what's so astoundingly interesting about all of this, and which leads to a completely different understanding of pretty much everything.
Yeah, having to do with creation physics and then the issues of human consciousness.
Yeah.
And then the ideas of evolution, like what evolution is, as we've discussed previously.
Yeah,
it's a whole different perspective, and it applies to the interpretation of science. You don't have to reject science to believe the secret doctrine. In fact, modern science
substantiates
what Blavatsky says.
Yes. Yeah.
Because now the what she was saying, which in her era were ideas way before contemporary ideas of her day, they've been substantiated by the development of physics over the past century.
Yeah, I mean, again, getting back to that, you know, like Monod's bad metaphysics, I would say, like in modern science, that the materialist reductionist approach to science and the materialist reductionist atheist approach to science is an interpretation of its facts is wrong. Like, I mean, the materialist position is clearly wrong. Like, it just doesn't stand up to the data. The data contradict the materialist position. You can understand things within a certain limited framework. You can understand them in terms of a materialist perspective, but you can't arrive at a comprehensive integration of the data of modern science from a materialist perspective. There's something beyond the materialist perspective, and I mean, in terms of an esoteric perspective, it's because you're trying to explain the entire universe or human consciousness, which are multidimensional phenomena in terms of one level. It's a flatland explanation of things that don't exist in flatland. They exist in multiple dimensions, and that's what's missing. It's like you don't get the higher dimensional perspective, which explains these things more coherently and comprehensively.
Yeah.
And that's what Blavatsky's providing. She's providing a multidimensional perspective on these issues that confront science and religion.
Yeah, today it's like her work, I don't think, has ever been more relevant than it is today with the most advanced 11-dimensional M theory and superstring theory and the holographic model in physics. Like, science only now has arrived at a point where it's elaborating concepts that she articulated a century ago.
Yeah,
it's astonishing, really. I mean, it's exactly congruent with her predictions.
Yeah, yeah. What's that? I don't know what century. You know, on your website, you have that quote when Jonathan Cott is talking to Rabbi Lawrence Kushner, and who's a Judaic scholar who's very interested in the confluence of ideas in the Kabbalah and modern science. He has some wonderful books, one of which I've read called The River of Light, which is really interesting. And he's talking about, I think, the 14th century, about rabbis talking about a supernal point source as the source of the universe. This is in the 14th century.
So, yeah, the Kabbalists, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the idea that these things have only been discovered by science that these essential facts about the nature of the of cosmogenesis is absurd. I mean, you know, I remember I told a friend of mine one time, well, how do you explain, a skeptic, how do you explain the fact that Blavatsky anticipated vacuum genesis and broken symmetries and seven-dimensional hyperspace, and I went on and on with this list of things that you have in one of your books. And his answer, I swear to God, this is an intelligent human being, a very intelligent human being, with a degree in the philosophy of science. His answer was, it was a coincidence.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I actually put that in one of my books in a footnote because I couldn't believe it. I said, I don't know if it's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life, but it's certainly in the running. I mean, think of that. I mean, that's just completely stupid, but that just shows how people are so resistant. You know, the so-called skeptics, which I mean, to be skeptical is to be open-minded to evidence. That's what being skeptical means. You know, I mean, how could you possibly ever come up with such an absurd explanation in quotes of things that you know don't fit your worldview? It's just completely ridiculous. And as Hawking says, you know, oh, nobody ever, you know, almost no one believed. I guess I'm not sure who he exempts from that belief that the universe didn't exist forever. I don't know who he has in mind when he says that, but he certainly wasn't thinking of Madame Blavatsky, I think, as one of the people who didn't believe that, you know, because I don't think he knows who Madame Blavatsky was or knows her work. So
it reminds me, like, for instance, you know, the scientists think that, well, in the 1980s, in that period, scientists arrived at the idea of vacuum genesis, that the universe emerged out of the quantum vacuum. And they don't realize that the idea that the universe, that there were realms of nothingness or non-existence that existed before the creation of the universe occurred, you find that in the Vedic teachings of India, because they have the... They say that before creation happened, the three modes of nature, the three gunas, are in perfect symmetry, hence signless, meaning unmanifest. And it's the white light of Brahman which penetrates in and breaks the symmetry of the gunas, which begins the generation of all the different particles and dimensions of existence. So you find it in the Vedas, this idea that there was a period where everything was absorbed in non-being.
Right.
And you find it in the first verses of the book of Genesis.
Yeah.
You know, that in the beginning God created heaven and the earth was empty and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially the concept of vacuum Genesis.
Yeah.
There was a period before creation manifested where everything was absorbed in the face of the deep. The deep, you know, which for Blavatsky would be the seven-dimensional hyperspace.
How old are the Vedas, do you think? Like,
I think they're dated 3,000 to 5,000 years old. I mean, you know. And then you find the same idea in Kabbalistic teachings.
Yeah.
They have three realms of non-existence called Ein Sof Hour.
Right.
And those represent nothing. The plenum, or infinite potential of all possibilities, and infinite light. And you look at modern idea of the quantum vacuum, and now scientists will think that this void, what seems to be a nothing to us, is really filled with infinite light, your electromagnetic radiation. It's this field of light, and that there's this infinite potential, and scientists describe the quantum vacuum now as the pleroma, which is the term used by the mystics. So you go back, and Kabbalistic teachings have been confirmed, I would say, by modern views of vacuum genesis. Just like the Kabbalists predicted the origination of the universe from a point source. You find that in Kabbalistic teachings as well.
Yeah.
So it reminds me, like scientists, it's like they think they discovered these things when these things have pre-existed for hundreds of years or even millennia before. And it reminds me of where people say, you know, Christopher Columbus discovered America.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, well, there were 15 million people here, you know. but when he comes over, like, he's this white guy from Spain, you know, and he's doing it for the Queen, and he discovered it, you know.
Yeah,
and there are already 15 million people here, you know, with advanced civilizations, you know.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's like the egocentrism of, you know, white European thought.
Well, talking about what you're talking about, the difference between the mystics and modern scientists. I mean, one thing is that, you know, in modern science, they say that the universe, the Big Bang, occurred because of a random fluctuation in the quantum vacuum.
A random
fluctuation, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know, since we don't have really anybody who was there to observe this and really explain it, that's sort of a construction as a, oh, it just happened. I mean, that maybe it did, maybe it didn't, you know. But it presupposes that there is nothing, no intelligence to allow this to happen or that move this to happen, you know. So there's a fundamental difference, I think, in between mystical and esoteric thought and modern science.
Yeah, and you see how, like, when you trace it all back, the scientist has a random quantum fluctuation, and that's equivalent in the mystical literature to the first manifestation of the will of God, either
right.
through light or sound, where God says, "Let there be light," and
yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it's
original
they
thought.
Think their formulation is scientific, but really,
yeah.
it's no more scientific than jumping to the conclusion that it's the will of God. I mean, neither of them is provable.
Yeah, well, neither of them is thought to be provable, but then
yeah.
you have, I would argue that you have people like the master yogis and people who have higher experiences of consciousness, such as in Yogananda's experience of cosmic consciousness, where people actually transcend time and space in their consciousness and can actually witness the creation of worlds and generally and this isn't exclusive but tend to describe a god as creating things or tend to in their explanations of things attribute things to God to a higher intelligence whatever that might be whatever you know it's sort of beyond our conceptualization or understanding. But, I mean, it's what I was going to say in relation to what we were talking about earlier, is that we have people who can come up intellectually with the idea of Bell's theorem, which is that that reality is non-local on some level, and yet you can have people who have directly experienced this, as they say in Yogananda's experience, his relation of his experience of cosmic consciousness. He is one with the universe, and so he exists, he transcends, his consciousness is unified with the universal structure and transcends time and space. So in a way, I would say that's a more...
Yeah. It provides evidence in a way, but
well,
not conclusive evidence.
It's empirical because he's observing
yeah.
something. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess the thing is that his experience, though, is so consistent with that described by other people who claim to have these experiences of higher states of consciousness that it's certainly, if you think of it as an experiment, the experimental evidence it tends to suggest that that what he's seeing is valid, that what he's... I'd qualify that because the way that it's interpreted, these are experiences which are beyond all of our categories of thinking and expressing ourselves. So there's always a danger in trying to reduce these things to, you know, to normal language. And I think often those explanations get caught up in whatever culture or historical period that a person having them is living in, but you know there's sort of a consistency there that tends to suggest that there is an intelligence which is at the heart of existence, and whether or not you want to call that God, I mean personally I don't care if it's you know that term is a loaded term, but I mean there is a higher intelligence. I think that's beyond doubt. It's like the
It's like the name is like an arbitrary thing, perhaps, in some way. Just like a rose is still a rose by any other name. Like you can call a rose in German, it has one word, in French another. It's just like how all different religions have different names for God. But, you know, God is still God, no matter what you, in different traditions, might name that.
And then I guess if something is known by its works, then I mean, then we get into things like in the mystical and esoteric tradition, the consistent description of the law of three and of the Holy Trinity, or whatever you want to call that, the three gunas or the three zazahat in Kabbalah. I mean, it's a consistent explanation which recurs, which is like the heart doctrine. It's there so frequently, so coherently, so comprehensively, so repeatedly, that it's not a coincidence. I mean, I think people are describing essentially the same thing within, as I say, within the limits of their own culture and their own historical period. And you know, there are different approaches to knowing these things. So, but it's certainly, and this is where Blavatsky's work is so interesting, because Blavatsky was probably the foremost esoteric scholar of modern times, in the sense that her work is based on the entire esoteric tradition, and that's where, I mean, she says it's based on the stanzas of Zion. I mean, I think there's pretty strong evidence to suggest that she drew from many, many sources in composing this material, or at least, well, let's put it this way, at the very least, it's entirely consistent with the esoteric tradition.
Yeah, I mean, no, she actually states that. Like, she states of her work that she writes, "The secret wisdom was once the fountainhead, the ever-flowing perennial source of which were fed all its streamlets, the religions of all natures from the first down to the last." So she is saying, she also says the aim of her book, The Secret Doctrine, is to rescue from degradation the archaic truths which are the basis of all religions, and to uncover to some extent the fundamental unity from which they all spring. So, in her book, I mean, it's a wealth of information, not only about Tibetan Buddhism, because the stanzas were supposed to be of Tibetan Buddhist origin, but she draws from esoteric Christianity, Kabbalistic teachings, Zoroastrianism, Chaldeanism, all these early Western esoteric traditions, which, you know, I don't think anyone had ever kind of drawn them together as systematically and coherently as she attempted to do. That's the subtitle of her book, is, what is it, The Synthesis of Science, Philosophy, and Religion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it is, you know, I think The Secret Doctrine, no matter what your religious background, whether a Kabbalist or a Christian or a Vedic scholar, that it helps you. It's not inconsistent with other esoteric teachings. It just helps you understand them.
I just wanted to ask you a question, because it's a question I know the answer to, but I remember you talking about, and I think actually, I may have actually been living with you when you first started reading The Secret Doctrine, but I do remember you telling me that in Donna's review, she says, Holmes begins by relating how the strange and seemingly incomprehensible stanzas of Zion. I remember you telling me that reading The Secret Doctrine was so difficult because it's very abstruse, it's very difficult to understand in many, many places what exactly she's saying, and that you worked and worked and worked and sort of had periods of kind of almost illuminated periods where the meaning of these things came to you. So perhaps you could just talk a little bit about that. I think that's a really interesting process, how you came to understand what she was actually saying.
Yeah, that's so true. I was trying to understand The Secret Doctrine. At the same time, I was studying, like reading modern books on physics. And that it was the conjunction of both of those I mean, it was having the physics background which enabled me to understand what she was getting at and to understand the stanzas. But then, I mean, I thought I went through periods of illumination and direct mystical experiences of some of the things she was talking about, like the nature of nothingness, the nature of the pleroma, and the broken symmetries in higher dimensional space. Like, it was like having direct experiences of some of those things. I remember at the time, I mean, I remember one time having tears streaming through down my eyes, from my eyes, because I felt I'd been graced. Like, sometimes mystical experiences I see as a function of grace, that you're given insights into the mysteries. And you know, you have to kind of make an effort to pull yourself up, but at a certain point, you're given grace. Like Yogananda was when his teacher Sri Yukteswar came over and he tapped Yogananda over the heart, and that awakened his experience, led to his experience of cosmic consciousness. In a way, he received grace from his teacher Sri Yukteswar, who was able to initiate that. And, you know, at different periods, I mean, I believe at times I had Blavatsky's help in the sense that I would feel her presence and her. So anyway, I did feel that I had mystical experience and received grace that allowed me to, you know, that was back in the mid 80s, over 20 years ago. And then since then, I've refined my understanding of these things more and more. You know, when I wrote my original notes up on the secret doctrine, I mean, when I was a professor at York back in the mid-80s, the main question on my course on science and mysticism was elaborate 10 ways in which modern science confirms the archaic teachings of the secret doctrine.
Oh.
And people had to come up with singularity creation, vacuum genesis, seven-dimensional hyperspace, expanding, contracting space-time, the enigmas of the uncertainty principle, and, you know, like, that was back in the mid-80s.
Yeah, because we were, I moved out of Major McKenzie in January or February of 1985, and I sort of remember that I think you were just starting to get into, like, in 1984 and into the secret doctrine. That's my recollection, but I wasn't sure if I was making that up, so that's interesting.
Yeah, no.
Asking those questions then, because I know you worked on it probably for a good 7 to 10 years in terms of like getting it and refining it, because I don't think you really started to generate the heart doctrine, and well, parts of the heart doctrine, but I mean, I don't think it was really until maybe a full 10 years later, like 1995, that you really started to generate material to a high level discussing the secret doctrine of modern physics, right? Like, I mean, because that's all.
Well, that's funny, because back in 1985, it was during that period when I lived in Maple and I had my office out on that abandoned bus.
Right.
That's where I had these experiences in that. That was in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
And I remember I wrote up, I had that like 30 to 40 page summary. And I remember going and meeting David Bohm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and giving him a copy of that, and you know, he was going to get back to me, but he never did.
I think he died.
Well, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But it's funny, different times I've taken my work to scholars who I thought might have a look at it and, like, give some support or comment on my work, and it never does. No one ever gets back to me. It's a peculiar thing.
It's interesting. I want to get back to this thing about grace, because it's funny, because at one point when I was trying to write about, and boy, I wrote it and I don't even know what book it's in, but it's in actually a couple of my books, but I think I used the term an animating grace to describe the kind of odd influence under which you and I seemed to exist for about 3 to 5 years when we first started studying the fourth way and trying to explore these ideas of Gurdjieff and square them with modern psychology. And you were working on your doctoral thesis, and I was working on my master's thesis.
Oh, yeah.
And we
animating grace. Yeah, perfect.
And it was like that, because when you say that, I don't think, well, and I was going to say, in some senses, I don't think I had the kind of the extent of the experiences that you had, like with these periods of illumination. But having said that, in the early 90s, I went to England, and I came back. And when I came back from England, I had this book, and I'd been working on it for, but at that point, probably 12 or 13 years. And I decided I was going to, I mean, I was sort of really frustrated because it was about us and about the fourth way and about the first years of our discovering it. And I decided, okay, I'm going to rewrite this book. I'm going to start over. And I began to rewrite this book. And I went through it, and something happened to me that I was on a completely different level in terms of my understanding of it all. And there were periods when I was writing it where it felt like I wasn't writing, like it was just sort of coming through me, and
yeah.
I just had to get out of the way and let it happen, you know. And I
yeah.
felt I was being guided, and I felt like I was something of a conduit for something higher than myself. And I don't say that to sort of, you know, exaggerate my own importance or anything, really quite the opposite, but it really felt like that I was being, you know, I was being informed.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating process. I mean, I
really
often remember the early studies we had of the Gurdjieff teaching, and we were going through our life and self-remembering, and his language, his understanding, like, about the centers and all the major issues of psychology. We were, in a way, continually gaining insights and illumination and having alternative perspective. It's a fascinating process, you know, like that kind of period of mystical growth.
Yeah.
You know, different phases of that I've found through life. And then some other times you kind of come down and you
yeah.
lose the sense of that. And then
yeah.
you can regain it even on a different level.
Yeah, and it's somewhat like a spiral, I think, in that sense. But I think that
yeah.
initial period is just so shockingly different. It's like the characters in fairy tales who fall asleep and dream, and then they're awakened. You know, it is an awakening in a sense, and you see everything has new meaning. I think that's what's so peculiar about it. Everything is seen in a new context, there's virtually nothing in your life that doesn't require re-examination, and you realize that much of what you've learned you have to unlearn because it's wrong, or you have to see it in a different perspective. And then as you say, that there comes a period when things sort of settle down, and then you have another period of renewal, and it starts up again, but now it's on a different level. And I mean,
yeah.
even something like, I mean, I remember I read Autobiography of Yogi and his account of his experience of cosmic consciousness, but it wasn't until a few years later when you'd read it and we started talking about it in terms of consciousness and light, and we sort of had an understanding of it, and you started to write about it, and then later I wrote about it, and then, but as time went on, as you learn more and more, you begin to see things in a much more comprehensive and coherent perspective. It's always deepening, right? Like the meaning
yeah.
of things, that's what esotericism does, is that it deepens your meaning. It's like by studying yourself and by acquiring the knowledge and the understanding, like through practical experience, it's kind of like esoteric ideas are sort of like this photographic paper that you put in this emulsion. That the emulsion or the solution is the work that you do. The more you work, the more it develops what's hidden, and the more the picture starts to come out, and the more the details are. But it's always, there's always more and more, and so you see connections and you see new meaning, and the picture keeps emerging and coming out the more that you put into it, sort of.
Yeah, it's a fascinating process like that.
Well, it
shows you, like, I see sometimes how some people kind of, like, talk of enlightenment as though it's a singular kind of thing, that you have an experience of enlightenment and then you're enlightened, kind of.
Yeah.
And it's so not what it is. Well, I mean, you can have periods of enlightenment. It's like climbing a mountain and you reach the first peak and then you realize, oh, you know, you think you reach a summit and you reach the first peak and then you realize you're just on the foothills.
Yeah.
You know, and it's layer upon layer of that, and that enlightenment isn't a singular entity, but there are levels of enlightenment and depths of enlightenment and you can have psychical experiences, but they're different than spiritual experiences, which are different from experiences of the divine realm.
Yeah.
You know, and so many people have experiences, and they're so overwhelming and powerful, you think you've been enlightened, but really it's what Carl Jung would call inflation. Mm. Kind of like you inflate, you know, you think you've seen God, but, you know, you've just made some major gains, but it might just be a beginning. It's a fascinating process. I mean, we've worked at our studies and integrated them into our lives for 30 years now. So, you know, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. I think a person has to make efforts to climb the ladder of self-realization, and that happens through our own efforts. Sometimes this mystical experiences just occur spontaneously to people. I remember famous Canadian psychiatrist Maurice Buck, who wrote the book Cosmic Consciousness. And in it, he recounts his experience. He doesn't say it's his, but apparently it is. It was his experience of one day being graced with this experience of enlightenment and realizing how everything was unified and part of God, and going around feeling filled with bliss and loving everything and feeling the Brahmic joy, he said. And so he had this amazing experience, but then apparently he never again was able to recapture what he experienced in that state. So it was like this awakening, but then you lose it. You fall down and you can't integrate it, or you don't then have easy access to those states.
Yeah. And even for people who follow an esoteric teaching, I mean, Gurdjieff talked about that at one point. He said that, you know, you can still, even if you've developed, you know, to a higher level of human being and you're self-conscious, you can still have moments when you lose that and you're not self-conscious and you can slip into a lower level, or that you can, I mean, there's different things that can happen. You can crystallize improperly too, but and be stuck in kind of an odd state or have certain powers, but at the same time be limited, limited by your improper development. I mean, there's so many different aspects to all of these questions, you know, about the nature of consciousness and and the development of consciousness. It's very difficult to it's much more complicated than I think people tend to, like, I think that's a really good statement you made. People tend to oversimplify it by saying, like, you're enlightened as if it's a one-shot thing, and okay, now I'm enlightened, so I'll be enlightened for the rest of my life. Well, even people who have a spontaneous experience, it can have a profound effect on them for the rest of their lives, but that doesn't mean that they're enlightened or that they're illuminated for the rest of their lives. It means that they've had a profound experience.
Yeah. And plus, when you come back down from such an experience, you may formulate what you experienced according to influences around you and your common thought, so you may really misrepresent what is occurring in your experience, because you fall back into the usual ways of thinking. Like someone, this whole thing about left brain, right brain, and how everyone in the mid-80s thought, you know, we got to develop this other mode of consciousness. Now there are two modes of consciousness, left brain and right brain, and we have to integrate them and have a whole brain. And it was so simplified, you know.
And I think that's a very good example, because I think that's one of the major misrepresentations and misunderstandings in modern thought, is that, there's certainly something to the left brain, right brain distinction in terms of different sides of the brain do tend to have structures that dominate certain types of activities, and they do tend to operate in distinct manners, but it's so grossly oversimplified to say that, you know, well, the left brain, everything's in the left brain and everything else is in the right brain. I mean, it's just, it's grossly oversimplistic, and again, it's premised on the accepting the head doctrine, is that your consciousness and your mind is in your head.
It's funny, the newest example of that was I heard David Icke being interviewed on Alex Jones on Prison Planet, And David Icke, I was shocked, was kind of identifying, you know, saying how we have to have this awakening and new consciousness, and he was identifying it with the right hemisphere. I couldn't believe it. I mean, he's not a psychologist, and Icke's work is very profound and deep. But then when it comes to the issue of consciousness, people are lost. That's how I see it. Even people in, you know, Icke's really at the forefront of, you know, recognizing the New World Order system and all, you know, what's going on the planet. But it doesn't mean then that you automatically, you know, understand the enigmas of consciousness. And this is something, like I see what's needed in our world today is the next stage of human evolution, I believe, is the awakening of the human heart. And you know, it's not the right hemisphere. It's the awakening of the human heart. I had one other note I wanted to just go back. You were talking about Gurdjieff. I think Gurdjieff's framework of ideas is very valuable, how he explains there are seven levels of human existence. And most people are man number one, two, or three. And the first level of awakening is to a man of number four, and the awakening of the higher emotional center and the attaining, having experiences of real I. And that's one level, but see, those are only the level of enlightenment of a man number four. But then beyond that, you have the level of a man number five, six, and seven, where a person acquires the experience of objective consciousness, as Gurdjieff calls it, knowing the truth about the world and the universe. So we might have an experience of enlightenment, but that's only still just on the level of a man number four. I remember in Carl Jung's book, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, he has a beautiful little passage about how one day he's kind of walking in the countryside, and he describes it. He felt as though he emerged out of a dream, and he had this new sense of self. And I would, and what he was describing, I would say, is his coming into the level of a man number four and having that experience of self-awareness. But that wasn't, you know, that's not the ultimate enlightenment. That's a step in this process. I wonder, Jim, maybe we should come back. We only have about 20 minutes or so. Yeah. Why don't we try to, we'll come back and we're going through this book review, and I think had come to some of the material on zero points and such.
I was going to suggest that too, that we've been, so I asked you about it. I was reading about the stanzas of Zion, which serve as the basis of the secret doctrine. And then Donna Brown's review continues, and this is, I think, critical. One of the foundational themes inspiring Holmes's work is the concept of zero point, a source point or singularity that, as Holmes points out, Blavatsky articulated a century before it came into common usage. She described these dimensionless points as, quote, material points without extension, the material She described these dimensionless points as, quote, material points without extension, the material out of which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies, unquote, and the single point or Leia point in which the entire universe concentrates itself. Okay.
Yeah, nice summary of the zero point concept.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's so much there in terms of what a zero point is. It's like, well, these are dimensionless points. This is Blavatsky. So the zero point concept is something which is so infinitesimally small that it's beyond measurement. It disappears into another dimension because it's not manifest in this dimension. I mean, was that how you would?
Yeah, it's a point from the perspective of physical existence and physical perception. It is a point so small it's beyond the level of our apprehension.
Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. And yet it in a way is a portal into higher dimensions.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's rooted into higher dimensions because it's the gods and other spiritual influences on higher planes of existence. Their influence and intelligence emerges through that zero-point center. So it's like a portal between the physical world below and the metaphysical world above.
Okay, I'm just going to continue because she actually goes on. The author expounds upon this concept at length, noting that the zero point is, quote, not exactly a thing in itself, so much as a condition or a place at which certain processes occur, unquote. He goes on to give a fascinating account of how, quote, the zero point hypotheses can be applied to the study of the macrocosm, the universe or cosmos, to quanta or elements, and to the study of the microcosm, the inner world of human consciousness and self-existence, unquote. Just as science conceives that the huge universe grew from an infinitesimal singularity out of a quantum vacuum, so also, as Holmes suggests, we have such a hidden zero point or singularity source condition, a singular I within the heart.
That was so beautiful how she expressed that and grasped that. Like, that's so profound. Like, in the book, the last third of the book is on consciousness studies and applies the zero-point concept to the heart. But before that, it's all on, like, singularities in physics and things like that. But that is so nicely how she embodies that, like, it's the essence.
Yeah,
I think of what's so unique about the book is that this idea of zero point, it doesn't only apply to the cosmos. It's also implied in the secret doctrine that it applies to ourselves, that we have a singular eye within the heart, that we have a zero point center.
And this is where I would say that your work is quite unique in the sense that it's not quite unique, it's unique in the sense that I don't think anybody else, that I don't know of anybody else who, first of all, extends the zero point to the level of human consciousness and says that, uses that as the basis of a model to suggest that there's an underlying physics which applies at both the level of the microcosm and the macrocosm. And what that does in your work, what your model of consciousness does, is it provides an explanation of the nature of things which is really in keeping, which reveals kind of the wisdom of these enduring esoteric aphorisms that, such as above, so below, the microcosm of the macrocosm, human being is a microcosm of the macrocosm. I mean, it specifically provides a model which in which those statements have profound meaning if you understand what they're referring to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're saying both the universe and an individual self emerges out of nothingness and has a first point of differentiation and a zero point center. Yeah, no, I don't know of anyone else in the literature who argues the same idea.
If there is somebody, I don't know who it is that says this, because I would say that this is so far out compared to most people who write about consciousness. I don't think anybody has this kind of idea. And what it really does, what this says, this is what I see as being so important, is that your perspective is you're saying human beings are multidimensional beings and that they exist in a multidimensional cosmos. And, I mean, it's easy to say that, but to really understand what that suggests, it's like what you were talking about earlier about Gurdjieff and his seven levels of human beings. Well, Gurdjieff says there's seven levels of the cosmos, too, and most esoteric teachings talk about this hierarchy of worlds in which the higher order worlds subsume the lower order worlds and inform them. So this too applies to human consciousness, so that you can reach these higher levels of consciousness in which the other levels below still exist and are intact, but from the higher perspective you can see how they're informed by the higher levels, and you can and there's an understanding of an apprehension of how these lower levels work and where they fit in the scheme of human consciousness. This also applies to creation. And this is the basis for a completely different understanding of the nature of everything. I mean, everything from the nature of the self and the I experience and human consciousness to the nature of the nature and purpose of the universe. I mean, it's an extraordinary model and conceptual position which allows for so many I would say, for the possibility of integrating knowledge from so many different areas into an entirely different understanding of everything.
Yeah, I agree. I think it does provide a model, absolutely. And you see that because really there are, for instance, so many evidences of human psychical experiences and out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, all of these things. But we don't have a model to explain, well, how is this possible? How does it work? And that is provided by my own work in kind of creation physics.
Yeah, and again, I mean, if you know, if somebody with a scientific interest were to approach this, these ideas and to incorporate them, like think of somebody like David Bohm, who developed the idea of the implicate order and the explicate order, and how the implicate order informed the explicate order, very much in keeping with this idea from esoteric teachings, but I would say like the original conceptualization he had is kind of formatory in Gurdjieff's terms. It's like it's cast in two, so you have the implicate order and the explicate order, but even he realized eventually that there had to be orders beyond the implicate order, so he posited the existence of the super implicate order.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe if he'd have been around long enough, he would have come to the idea of, like, you know, seven levels of orders, or you know, I don't know, maybe, I mean,
well, that would have been an extension of his work. That's a good example.
Yeah, and see, that's where I think that if you study esoteric ideas, this is where you get an entirely different sense of the nature of everything, and it provides an intellectual framework to understand things in an entirely different way from the way that we're taught in Western thought as to how to conceptualize things, which, as you've pointed out many times, is essentially very dualistic and really doesn't even recognize the third force in most things, let alone the idea of a fourth and a fifth and a sixth and a seventh level of things. But this is an entirely different perspective. And then with that, too, is the idea of that not only are things evolving, but things are involving. I think that's like such a critical idea that's missing in modern thought. And again, like that's how you get this idea. Well, okay, we have a mind. Okay, from an evolutionary perspective, the mind's got to be produced by a lower level. It's evolution means to grow more complex. So okay, so this is produced by the activity of the physical activities of the neurons in the brain. But from an esoteric perspective, the involutionary process allows for things to occur by a higher source of intelligence informing a lower level of intelligence or realm, and that's what you're kind of suggesting, and well, not kind of suggesting, that's what you're suggesting in your model, is that we are informed in our consciousness and our being by these higher sources of intelligence and consciousness.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is completely and utterly profound.
It's all through the physics of the heart. Plus, there's other centers in the body, like the whole chakra system. I mean, each chakra has a zero-point center, and they're all part of one.
I wanted to ask you that today. Is that okay? Would you say like that there are like the chakras represent like seven zero-points within the body, but like that the heart is the master chakra because
That's right. The one becomes seven.
Seven, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the one to manifest, it manifests as seven. So each chakra has a vortex, rotating aspect, but each chakra has a zero-point center,
right,
which is the essence of that. And all the chakras emerge out of the heart chakra.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so drawing upon a wealth of scientific papers, books, and diagrams, Holmes explores accepted and cutting-edge theories in science, including those of Einstein, Stephen Hawking, and David Bohm, to name a few. The general theory of relativity, quantum theory, Bell's theorem, the concept of holism, and numerous other theories such as superstring and M-theory are explained in a concise and clear fashion. These same concepts are then aligned or contrasted with the secret teachings to reveal a supremely valid portrait of how the universe works and was created. We learn from Holmes how Blavatsky's notion of the seven-skinned eternal parent can be linked with, quote, what science now describes as seven-dimensional hyperspace, and with the newer M theory and the Calabi-Yau spaces that exist at every point underlying the four-dimensional complex, unquote. And that Blavatsky's view of space, a living unity or plenum, can be linked to Bohm's view of space, quote, as the container of the implicate orders, unquote. Wow. Care to amplify on that?
Yeah, it's great. Like, I mean, you look at the book, I mean, I really do, you know, draw from all these major theorists and major concepts, you know. Like, there's good coverage of the uncertainty principle and Bell's theorem and Bohm's work and, you know, you draw from a lot of sources.
Yeah.
And it just enriches it.
I can't imagine anybody being interested in cosmological ideas or in consciousness ideas not reading your book and being at least mildly provoked at the very least by I mean, even if you like vehemently disagree with it, I think you'd have to, if you read your book, if someone read your book, even who was adhered to a very different perspective, I think they'd be really
it's kind of incumbent upon them to.
Well, I think they would be shocked in the Gurdjieff sense. Like, I think they would certainly be provoked to consider these ideas and your interpretation of both the ancient wisdom and modern scientific ideas and the way that you integrate them. I think people would definitely be interested in this. It would be incumbent upon them to explain how you're wrong because or how you're mistaken, because I think it's a very, very provocative book.
Because the parallels are clearly drawn.
Yeah,
and there are remarkable parallels. So I mean, it's incumbent. You can't just dismiss it in saying, "Oh, this is mystical" or "This is metaphysical," and dismiss it on that basis because it's very succinct and clear and it's supported by the interpretation of modern theories.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so we got one paragraph left.
Oh, yeah.
I noticed we just got about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, okay. While portions of this book are not easy going, Holmes plunges the reader into the deep places of the occult and the new frontiers of science to come up with a lucid and provocative book. Exactly. It unseals many of the secret doctrines, mysteries, as it weaves the seeming opposites of spirit and science into a new synthesis. That's lovely. It is a must-read for those wishing to understand the complex and seemingly impenetrable world of Helena Blavatsky, alongside the newest ideas of quantum theory. Absolutely true. Holmes has created something of his own tour de force in God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. I agree. His book is destined to serve as a guidebook for all those that follow. Dr. Holmes hosts an online internet radio broadcast every Saturday through www.bbsradio.com. Yeah, and that's it.
Well, that's from Donna Brown,
book review.
And I'm most appreciative of that she really obviously is a brilliant woman to really grasp my work, which I think she has done and saw its uniqueness.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a tour de force. I mean, I don't know, I wouldn't say anything comparable to it in its sophistication of attempting to relate ancient metaphysics to the newest concepts in physics. And then it ties the whole thing in to your own psychology, saying this whole thing is a model of human existence. So it's not just talking about the universe out there, but also our own nature as beings, living beings.
Yeah, and boy, I'm not sure what to add to that. I mean, I completely agree, I think it's funny because before we came on the air, I was reading part of the book that I'm trying to write, and I was talking about your early career as a graduate student in psychology and what happened to you in terms of your failure to get tenure at York University, and you know, you could have had a very conventional career, but I mean, this is what real psychology, I would say, is about, and I think that what passes as psychology. psychology is as you say, it's a pseudoscience. I mean, there's something to it, but it's so simplistic, it's so restrictive in its parameters that it explores things, and it's based on so many incorrect assumptions about the nature of self and reality and consciousness and being that it really is doomed until, as Uspensky said, science must come to mysticism, eh? Because that's really where science has to go in order to deal with the host of anomalies and enigmas and mysteries that confront it. And I think, as I say, if someone with an open mind reads your book, I think they'd be quite astounded at the model that you're putting forth and how I see it. I mean, I see it because I've been thinking it for a long time, but I see how it really does provide a model to explain so many of these mysteries and enigmas and anomalies that exist within the current paradigm in modern science and psychology.
And you see also how you're growing, your understanding of these things grows organically in you over time. Like,
yeah.
You could never just explain to someone new what a zero point is and have them really grasp it.
No, you can't.
You know, it grows, yeah, over years and decades even.
Yeah, you can't understand anything. All of these things, they start like seeds and they grow and they become full plants and then they blossom. And I mean, it's just like that. It's like that. It's an ongoing process and it's organic and it's amazing how the same things can take on entirely different new meaning as your understanding of things evolves. It's an extraordinary process, and I mean, I just feel fortunate to have over the last 30 years had the opportunity to study these ideas with you, because it leads to such a much deeper understanding and insight into, you know, what we're here for, might all mean. I mean, it's incredibly inspiring when you try to understand these things. It makes you feel small, and it makes you feel that you have fantastic possibilities.
Yeah, the small and at the same time the center of the universe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
As Blavatsky says, the center which is everywhere and nowhere.
Nowhere, yeah, yeah,
yeah,
exactly, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
and it makes you feel that, you know, on some level, all the horror it can be resolved, you know, on some other level, that because it's a very profound, what she provides is a very profound teaching about the nature of things, which really should get its due. And it's amazing that, you know, it's, what, 112, 119 years later, or 121 years later, you know, we're still, she still really isn't getting her due. And,
yeah,
hopefully she hasn't.
No.
Hopefully this is a step in the right direction. I do hope that this book gets published by a mainstream publisher and that people, you know, review it and other people understand it as well as Donna's understood it.
Yeah, yeah, me too. Yeah, I have sent it to Wiser, but I haven't heard back yet, but I would have expected it to take a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll need to close down.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Jim. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yep, thanks to BBS.
And, yeah, thank you, Don and Doug and BBS. And I would like to encourage people to visit my website at zeropoint.ca. And I do have donate buttons there. If anyone would ever like to help donate to support me in my own studies, I know through 3 years of 4 years of working under Zero Point and requesting donations through my own website and online here, I've received $110. So I'm not making a lot of money through my work. And I do appreciate support. And I have copies of these books. I print them out on my own printer and I sign them. So if anyone's interested in a copy, you get an early edition autographed copy. Okay, thanks very much, BBS, Jim Moffat, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Remember yourself, keep heart.
Okay.